Well, welcome to the streaming Bill and Wendy, who are not here. I am Rick Kogan, and I guess I can like be like Howard Stern and swear and say horrible things, and I guess that's what streaming is all about. In this Sunday's, it was fun filling in for Bill and Wendy for a couple hours. We had some very interesting guests on from 10 to noon. And I, as ever, thank Kevin Richter producing and Bob Ferguson, greatest engineer who's ever lived. We used to do the Sunday papers together for many years, and we had some strange weirdos who would always come in, to be unnamed now, would come hang around the station. One of those was not Mike Royko. Mike Royko died 20 years ago this month. And this Sunday's Chicago Tribune will feature, it's not a tribute, it's just kind of a remembrance of Mike. I wrote a story talking about remembering Mike, and there's also going to be excerpts from some of his columns and maybe an entire column. You know, as you know, he wrote for the Daily News and then the Sun-Times, and then he came to the Tribune, where he famously referred to the Sun-Times, which has just recently been purchased in 1984 by Rupert Murdoch, as a fish that is publishing newspapers that no self-respecting fish would want to be wrapped in. Mike did have a way with words. Not everybody liked Mike, but it was really impossible not to read him every day. It was sort of like, you read Royko? That was a common phrase. And this is in the day when people used to, you'd get on a bus or an L and everybody was reading a newspaper. They did not have, there were no iPads. I'm not sure there were little tiny cell phones. I think phones were as big as like a shoe. So it's nice to remember Mike. And in about, I don't know if you want to call your relatives, in-laws, and good friends and tell them in about 7 or 8 or 9 minutes, I'm going to play you, as I always do in the springtime, a spectacular 9 minutes of Mike Royko caught not off guard, but having beers after a softball game at the Billy Goat, talking about his life as it associates to 16-inch softball, and it is among the best off-the-cuff routines, some of it funny, some of it very poignant, about the meaning of 16-inch softball in Mike Royko's life. I now, because Tuesday at the Hideout, Michael Miles and I, who've been doing a show, the great musician Michael Miles and I have been doing a show called Panorama for 3 months. It started as a kind of experiment, and some of you, incredibly nice people, have been coming there. So it's now a kind of ongoing thing. We're going to be doing a kind of musical spoken word tribute to Mike. And $10 to get in. Hideout's a great place. You're going to have to Google Hideout, Kogan, blah, 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 and get it. You can go to a place called Ticket Fly, and you can buy tickets. It's going to be an homage to Mike. So I'm going to give you a sampling of Mike Royko through the years. Here he is on Minority Voters. The enormous black vote had given Daley, this is the first Daley, his victory. The people who were trapped in the ghetto slums and the nightmarish public housing projects, the people who had the worst school system and were most often degraded by the police department, the people who received the fewest campaign promises and who were ignored as part of the campaign trail, had given him his third term. They had done it quietly, asking for nothing in return, which is exactly what they got. That's Royko. Here he is, and he wrote, and one of the great things about Mike is he wrote on a breadth of topics. He wasn't just a one-topic kind of columnist. Here he is on fashion. Year after year, a handful of suspicious-looking characters who call themselves clothing designers issue their commands. Wear your dress short and wear boots and look like a hooker. Now throw them away and wear them long and look like a frump. Now, dress like a gypsy fortune teller. Now, look like a farm wife. Now wear spike heels. Now show your thighs. And every time the pimps of fashion give the word, all these enlightened female persons obediently trudge to the clothing stores. With that attitude, they might as well be fetching a pipe and slippers. He was something. Here's one from 1988 on Alder Boobs. You may remember Alderman Ernie Jones. He's the statesman who recently said female cops too many... He is the statesman who recently said female cops take too many days off because of their, quote, minister periods. I'm not sure who was more confused and offended, the lady cops or their ministers. Now Jones has turned his pea-sized intellect to other pursuits, art criticism and constitutional law. Jones was one of the City Hall hysterics who took it upon themselves to yank a painting out of the School of the Art Institute because it offended them. Everybody remember this painting? Remember that famous painting? A student thought it was clever to draw the late Mayor Harold Washington in women's undergarments. Someone called a black alderman or two, and they spread the word among their colleagues, and everybody went berserk. Several rushed to the Art Institute, probably for the first time, to seize the painting. But fearing that the students might splatter them with white paint, they backed down and had the police confiscate the painting for them. The police justified the seizure by saying that a painting of Harold in female undies might incite black citizens to riot. Actually, if anyone was incited to riot, it was a handful of alder boobs. There certainly were no reports of blacks milling about the Robert Taylor homes, Cabrini Green, or West Side Street saying, "My man, have you heard about the offensive portrait of Harold at a private showing in the School of the Art Institute? Shall we show our displeasure by going there and trashing a Monet or two?" I'm not kidding. I'm looking at Bob Ferguson, my friend, while I'm doing this, and it just is too funny. On precinct captains. A decent precinct captain used to be out there with a big wad of bills, big enough to choke his clout, handing a few dollars to every needy voter. And there was nothing wrong with that. With the kind of alderman Chicago's had, people should be paid to vote for them. Here's a really good one. This is one of his most famous ones. It's not the whole thing, but it's pretty good. Mike was out there the day they unveiled the Picasso, August 16th, 1967. There was a gasp as the light blue covering fell away in several pieces. But it was caused by the basic American fascination for any mechanical feat that goes off as planned. In an instant, the Picasso stood there for all to see. A few people applauded, but at best it was a smattering of applause. Most of the throng was silent. They had hoped, you see, that it would be what they had heard it would be. A woman, maybe. A beautiful, soaring woman. That is what many art experts and enthusiasts had promised. They had said that we should wait, that we should not believe what we saw in the pictures. Well, if it was a woman, then art experts should put away their books and spend more time in girly joints. The silence grew. Then people turned and looked at each other. Some shrugged, some smiled, some just stood there, frowning or blank-faced. Most just turned and walked away. The weakest pinch hitter for the Cubs receives more cheers. You see, they had wanted to be moved by it. They wouldn't have stood there if they didn't want to believe what they had been told, that it would be a fine thing. But anyone who didn't have a closed mind, which means thinking that anything with the name Picasso connected must be a wonderful, you could see nothing but a big, homely metal thing. That is all there is to it. Some soaring lines, yep. Interesting design, I'm sure. But the fact is, it has a long, stupid face and looks like some giant insect that is about to eat a smaller, weaker insect. It has eyes that are pitiless, cold, mean. But why not? Everybody said it had the spirit of Chicago, and from thousands of miles away, accidentally or on purpose, Picasso captured it. Up there in that ugly face is the spirit of Al Capone, the Somerdale scandal cops, the settlers who took the Indians, but good. Its eyes are like the eyes of every slum owner who made a buck off the small and weak, and of every building inspector who took a wad from a slum owner to make it all possible. It has the look of the dope pusher and of the syndicate technician as he looks for just the right wire to splice the bomb to. Any big-time real estate operator will be able to look into the face of the Picasso and see the spirit that makes the city's rebuilding possible and profitable. It has the look of the big corporate executive who comes face-to-face with the reality of how much water pollution his company is responsible for, and then thinks of the profit and loss and of his salary. It is all there in that Picasso thing, the I will spirit. The I will get you before you get me spirit. Picasso has never been here, they say, but you think he's been riding the L all his life. Isn't that amazing? He went there, he was with Studs Terkel, he stood in what was then Civic Center Plaza. He saw it unveiled, he went back and he wrote that. Pretty amazing. Now, for your listening pleasure, thanks to the great producer Kevin Richter, here's Mike Royko from many years ago, a guy named Scott Jacobs had his pretty big video camera and wanted to get Mike talking about softball. So he went down to the Billy Goat after a game, and this is what he got.
Guys who are obsessive sophomore players, they want a game every minute. They want to play. They sit at home, and they're known. They're softball junkies. It's known, you know, that Joe Glass, a great player, if you can get him, he'll play for you any tonight. So you got a decent team. He won't play for a lousy team. No good softball player wants to play for a lousy team. But you call him. You say, Joe, you got a game this afternoon? No. Hey, I can use a guy. I can use a guy in center field. Can you come out? Yeah, what time? There are guys like this who play 150 games a summer. Well, when you consider that, that's all a Major League Baseball player plays. He doesn't do anything else. Well, this guy may be a baggage hand. He may work in a factory 8 hours a day. And he still will squeeze 150 games a summer in. Every day after work he will play. Because he loves it. He loves it. He loves that moment when the bat hits the ball and he gets the fast jump in center field and he's moving. And he leaps up and makes that over-the-shoulder catch. I mean, that's it. It's the fun. It's the fun of the game. If you work for the state of the Chicago Police Department, it's very easy to put together a great team. All cop teams are good teams because they're made up primarily of native-born Chicagoans who played softball, macho males. And it's easy to put out a good company team. If you play for a company like mine that has a very relatively small number of people, and a lot of them are Ivy Leaguers who aren't very good at softball because they don't want to hurt their hands, then it's very hard to put out a good softball team. So my team is not a pure Sun-Times team. No, I admit there are people on my team who may not work for the Sun-Times. I mean, a ringer is somebody you bring out, a special player you may pay for a money game. Well, we don't have guys like this. And my ringers are really, my best players are not ringers. The best player on my team is obviously me, and I'm not a ringer. But I do have a couple guys who don't earn all their income working for my team. The greatest team 5 years ago in America was a team called the Strikers. They were the defending national champions. They were the greatest team you ever saw. And so one weekend, the following year, their manager, who was also my chief ringer, called me and said, "We need a pitcher this weekend." I said, "Who needs a pitcher?" "Hey, Sammy, get around." So I said, "You need a pitcher?" "Me?" He says, "Yeah, We're in a big tournament, important tournament. We got to have a pitcher. Coming out, there I am, pitching for the Strikers against a super team. Because they played nothing this super. These teams, the super teams all play super teams. And we won. We played another game in the afternoon. We won. Now we got to play in the evening. And I'm high. Ooh, I'm high. Because I'm not only am I pitching, but I'm hitting. I was 2-3 in both games. So we go out that night and we win again. Oh, man, now I did it. I pitched for the Strikers. Well, we went out and had a few drinks. Now my family's in Wisconsin. I have a summer home in Wisconsin. So now I got to go from the suburb to Wisconsin. I don't know how to get to Wisconsin from the suburb. So we have a few beers, and I take off of Wisconsin, and I get lost. It's very easy to get lost in Wisconsin. Wisconsin all looks alike. So I'm driving around, and I see this sign that says Roadhouse. Pull in, go, and I want directions. While I'm there, I have a drink. Got a uniform on with a jacket over. A Striker's uniform. World champion Striker. So I got my jacket on. I go and have a drink, and I ask the guy for directions, give me directions, and like all Wisconsin rural roadhouses, everyone's there, you know, teenagers shooting pool, adults eating dinner, drunks drinking, and everybody goes to the saloons in Wisconsin, little town. So finally the bartender says to me, what have you been playing, softball? I said, no, I always walk around with spikes on my shoes, went fishing. I haven't played softball. He said, where do you play? Chicago. Where do you play? 12-inch, 16-inch, 16-inch. He said, oh, we play 16-inch up here. I said, oh, really? I didn't know you played. We got a decent team. The Pell City Danons. Did you ever hear of us? I said, the Danons. Have I ever heard of the Danons? The Danons are the only non-Chicago team ever to finish in the top three in the Nationals. You have a super team. You finished third last year in the Nationals. You have a marvelous team. And he says, hey, know about our team. And everybody in the bar gets excited because a guy knows about their team. And they're all running up and saying, you know about our team, huh? You know, we got a great team. We finished third in the Nationals, blah, blah, blah. And they're all excited. And so we're all talking about how good the Danons are, and they're good because they have Chicagoans who go up there and play on their team. So, and the bartender paused the conversation and says, who do you play for? I said, who do I play for? Zip. The Strikers, national champion. My God! He's a Striker! Because when they finished third, the Strikers went first, and they got hysterical. People were running up to me saying, he's a Striker. Oh, my God. He's a Striker. Let me shake your hand. Oh, you're a Striker. And people were running up. Give him a drink. He's a Striker. And then it was, I knew then how it felt to be Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays. They were just, blew their minds. But finally, this old geezer standing in the bar, and he looks over at me. He said, what the hell position do you play? I said, well, I don't play ever. I pitch occasionally.
Yeah, the game really got started in Chicago
when I grew up. There was big league softball in Chicago. You had stadiums, your Windy City League. You go out and pay a dime to get in. See three games. But every neighborhood in the city played 16-inch softball. My father owned a saloon. My father sponsored the team. And this was big time. When you lived in a neighborhood where a guy sponsored a serious team, I mean, a kind of team that was where you'd say, we're going to play a South Side team. We're a North Side team. We're playing a South Side team. And this is maybe 1941. And we're playing for $100. Now, $100, $50 was a damn good salary in those days. $100, you were an executive. We're talking about like $1,000 today. And when the word would go out to the neighborhood, the Blue Sky Lounge team is playing the Purple Snakes from 63rd Street, a bunch of Lithuanians, then, you know how many people would come out for the game in the neighborhood? 2,000-3,000 people. And this was the biggest event of the month, maybe the year. This is a big deal. And Gary, you know, you run up and down, pass the hat, collect money. Collecting money. And the guys throw nickels in and pennies in there. Well, what you collect money for is a drink afterwards. You never told people you collect your money for. You know, they all man a drink, you know. That's the way America was 40 years ago. They throw the money in. And it's, you have this incredible game. Hopefully you would win it. I got to play on that team. Of course, my father owned it, but I was still good enough to make it. And it was the greatest thrill of my life as a kid, playing on my old man's saloon team. But these were great ball players. We had a first baseman, Joe Gabrowski, who wound up as a played 14 years in the NBA, National Basketball Association. Elbows Joe. He's my father's first baseman. Never went to college. The reason he quit high school was my old man would serve him beer. He figured, why do I want to go to college? I can get beer right here.
When are you going to give it up?
I'm going to play softball. Well, as long as I'm a manager, I'm going to play. Because I always write out the lineup. I say, Royko, pitcher, batting 10. And I think that what is eventually going to happen is I'll come up in a game. Well, we're down by 4 runs. No, 3 runs. We'll be down by 3. That'll be the last half of the 7th inning. 2 outs. The bases will be loaded. And I'll come up to the plate. And they're going to look at me and say, well, the old geese is up. So they'll come in a little. And I'm going to rip one over the left fielder's head. And I'm around third. I'm the winning run. And just as I approach home plate, I fall over dead right on the plate.
Or you wake up.
And they'll hold a wake right there. I came up against Andy Frame in the last half of the last inning when I pumped a home run. And I'll tell you, that the Pulitzer Prize didn't compare with the kick I got as I was coming around third.
Take up this streaming hour with 10 minutes of Mike Royko talking about softball. Hi, Judy Pilak.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. You do the news on this thing, too?
I do.
Wow.
I know. Only the best.
I feel honored. I do.
Would you like me to do the news now?
Only if it's good news. Oh, what do you mean break? What do you mean? Me take a break? Yeah, I'm sick of talking. Well, we have commercials. I'm sick of talking. This is 2.5 hours, man. I can't do it anymore. I've got one more interview to do, though, because it's very important to Kevin because he has tattoos and we're interviewing a tattoo guy. So I'm taking a break. Hi, this is Michael Miles playing the guitar. He and I have been doing a show at the Hideout every Tuesday, once a month, on the, third Tuesday. We'll be doing one this Tuesday that is kind of in honor of Mike Royko. Mike Royko, as far as I know, and I probably saw him in the shower after we played handball sometime. I don't know if Mike had a tattoo, but most of my friends do have tattoos. That is why it is my great pleasure to host, because I'll learn something from him. Benoit, who runs Deluxe Tattoo at 1461 West Irving Park Road, celebrating its 20th anniversary. Ben, I know you're on the road. I know you had to pull over to do this interview, but I'm really grateful to you.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Where are you headed, or where are you? Or can you say?
My daughter's on break for the holidays, so we're off to Indianapolis for the Easter weekend.
Oh, that's not bad, so I won't take up too much of your time, and you're not that far away. All right. What is your background, and how did you come to the tattoo business? Because just in talking to a few people over the last 2 days, and again, I've never had a tattoo. I've thought about it a couple times, but restrained myself. Your place is admired by three people this morning who I talked about having you on. Go, oh my God, I love that place. How did you start in this? You must have started, I assume, with getting a tattoo.
So I come from no art background. I had no family that did art. I grew up, I was working at a comic book store, became very interested in comic book art, started pursuing art kind of in that direction. But the more I got towards it, the more I'm talking to people, I'd find out how restricted that field would be, how limited, you know, 2 or 3% of the artists involved in that field.
Oh, I know.
Really it's
yeah, incredibly competitive, I would think, right?
Yeah, and just didn't really, once I found out more about it, I just kind of lost interest in it. My parents are all in the education, Chicago public school system. So, you know, maybe an art teacher. Kind of got to a place where I just wasn't sure where I was going.
Sure.
And then I met a guy who was a tattoo artist, and he liked my artwork, and we had a lot in common. And he gave me the opportunity, and he said, you know, it's something you like to pursue. You know, you got skills for it. And I thought, you know, maybe this isn't for me. But then, you know, I said, why? You know, it became more of a why not than a why. You know, all the stereotypes that I had in my head of the industry.
Sure.
You know, some of them were actually true, but there was a lot that I found out I was totally wrong about.
When this guy, your mentor, said you've got the skills for it, what now, after all these years in the business, what does that mean? What are the skills?
Well, so artistically speaking, more than anything, because him and me are also both into a lot of the same artists and stuff. But you don't really need to be an awesome artist to do a tattoo. There's some people that are pure technicians.
Gotcha.
They're like human copy machines that do absolutely beautiful tattoos and could not draw a stick figure.
Oh, interesting.
It's absolutely true. There's award-winning tattoo artists out there that are, you'd see their work, and I don't want, you know.
You don't have to name them, but
they literally would have to pay people to switch a drawing for them because they couldn't do it themselves.
That is fascinating. Why do you think that is? I mean, what kind of you know, weird artistic synapses are not firing for them where they can do a great tattoo?
The brain is a strange thing. I mean, there's some people, like I said, they're human photocopiers. They have the innate ability to sit there and duplicate something perfectly, but they just cannot create. That'd be like saying that, yeah, you know, you played the best Kiss cover band that ever existed, but you cannot write one song to save your life.
That is so, yeah, I get it. I'm starting to get it. I'm on the phone with Benoit, who is the owner and artist behind Deluxe Tattoo. They're having their 20th anniversary celebration Saturday, April 22nd, from noon to 10 p.m. at 1461 West Irving Park Road. Do you remember, Ben, making your first tattoo, and was it?
Oh, absolutely.
What was it?
So the guy I started with, he even admits it was actually a really bad idea, but he had me do an ankle band, which was a Celtic design, which is interlooping repetitive design work that I had to hand draw on with a ballpoint pen perfectly and then execute. And with a ballpoint pen, the problem is that if you rest your hand on it while you're working, smear it. So you have to be really meticulous while you're working,
right,
not to touch it. So, and absolutely the worst possible way to start tattooing. And I guess it was kind of good because it was kind of a, you know, pass or fail. You know,
sure,
if you attempted this and you really got overwhelmed and gave up, then walk out the door and don't ever try again.
Or the person started screaming and pulled their arm away and ran out the door.
Yeah.
Did you do it? Was the first tattoo you drew on a friend or a...
No, for myself, actually. I mean, I drew my first tattoo. And I drew several versions. I was super, you know, picky about it, and the guy butchered it that did it. I remember getting home, taking the bandage off, and looking at it and thinking, oh, my God, what a mess.
You got a good, refreshing attitude about all this. So how does it become for you after this first experience? How does it become a career and then a business?
Momentum, you know. You get going in something, and it captures you. You know, let me tell you this. When I started tattooing, it was absolutely the craziest human beings I had ever dealt with in my life. I remember thinking to myself, these people are out of their minds.
How do you mean? I mean,
well,
mentally, you know, unstable?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you come from a standard background, you know, blue-collar neighborhood, working people. What's the worst? Some people get drunk, have some beers.
Yeah, right.
You know, some guy crashes car, whatever. Oh, we're talking heroin addicts. We're talking weapons, white supremacists. I mean, you're talking all kind of crazy stuff.
Where were you? Where
time? Who was literally like in tears, like, you have to get out of this place.
Where were you?
You're gonna die.
Where, Benoit? Where were you when you first started doing this? Were you in some? Obviously, it was in someone else's shop. It wasn't in like your basement.
Yeah, I have a friend who has a shop in Champaign, Illinois.
Yeah.
And he's the one that initially helped me get my foot in the door. And you know, I was there for about 8 or 9 months. He had good intentions, but it was not going as I would hope it would go.
Well, it sounds like you would be afraid. It sounds like you would be understandably afraid every time the door opened. Like, who was going to walk in, a neo-Nazi or a, You know what I mean?
The thing is, if you knew me, you'd know the word afraid isn't really part of my position.
Well, anxious.
I might be a little stupid in that way, but I should be afraid of things that I'm not afraid of.
So
but,
dealing...
talk about, you watch these movies of, like, you know, people's upbringings. And it's an adventure. You know, you're living the movie.
Yeah.
You don't know one person you grew up with that's having as crazy as a life as you're having at that moment. And I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't do anything. I mean, I'm not sitting there partying, but, I mean, I ended up in shops full of junkies. I ended up, you know, front line for all this stuff. But I also ended up surrounded by some of the best people in the field. So, you know, on one hand, you're dealing with the Michael Jordan of tattooing, and on the other hand, you're dealing with bum. So, you know, having this spectrum...
It obviously makes for a very interesting day at work, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. This is the thing I tell people, too.
Yeah.
If I could go back and trade all that time for a free ride at Harvard, there is no way I would do it. What you're going to learn in the street and dealing with people on a daily basis and being in these situations, you would never learn in a classroom. Not a million years.
What's the road, Benoit, from your 8-9 months in Champaign to working, to owning your own business? What's that interlude between, like?
You know what?
What?
It's good people. It's meeting the right people. It's having people that were... genuinely interested in helping me instead of just trying to hurry me out the door or shortchange me. I was very lucky. I mean, I met some really nice, good people that genuinely, you know, took an interest in me and helped me do what I needed to do. It was luck, you know. There's a lot of people that love me in this industry, and they just can't get a foot in the door.
Yeah.
And without that, it's very difficult.
So you leave Champaign and you make your way to Chicago at that point?
Yeah, well, I had the opportunity to get a job at a place a friend of mine knew on the South Side where I grew up, and I went there, and I was there for about 2 weeks. And I
on the South Side did you grow up?
Beverly.
Did you? Okay. Nothing wrong with that.
Only Jew in Beverly.
That may be. Well, I'm a half Jew, and I've visited a number of times, so maybe we share that. I get it. And then you worked here, and...
So I was at this place briefly, and a guy came back that wanted his job back. He was much more experienced and way better than I was at that point. And they said, well, we need someone good for the summer, and you're not, so bye. So there I was with nothing. So I just continued to tattoo on the side of my friends' houses until I could get a portfolio of work together to try to walk in somewhere and get a job. And, like, the third time I was doing it, a guy walked in the doorway who had heard the machine. He walked in and asked me to see what I was doing. I said, yeah, I came over to see what I was doing. And it turned out to be a guy named Bob Oslin. He used to own a shop on Lincoln and Grace, and he hired me on the spot. So I got very lucky.
Wow.
Again, you know, lucky.
Yeah, you're right. Well, so, you know, one of the other...
My first day was great, though, because he shows up to help me get settled in and leaves. And his words were, you know, I'm not going to leave you to the wolves. You know, I'll be here to help you. And I tell that to the guys at work, and they all laugh. They're like, Ben, he's here once every 2 weeks, maybe. So, yes, you've officially been left to the wolves.
That is a great, great, great story. But it also is indicative, Ben, don't you think, of what happens when you really do follow your own passion. That kind of serendipitous encounter does happen, don't you think?
Yeah, persistence. You know, I heard an interview with John Waters the other day, and he said the best thing. He said, no's are free. People say no is free.
Yeah.
Try. And that's the thing. If you're persistent and you have a passion for what you do, you will do it eventually. But you just cannot give up if you really want to do something.
And so 20 years ago, because you're now celebrating the 20th anniversary of Deluxe Tattoo at 1461 mm-hmm. West Irving, how did you got enough dough to buy a store? I haven't seen the place, but you got enough dough to buy a storefront and decided to go out on your own, right?
Well, I rent. I don't buy.
Oh, okay.
You area there,
right?
But you know, I had to borrow some money from some people, which I paid back promptly.
And, sure.
You know, I had my own savings, but at that time it was extremely difficult. There was only maybe a dozen shops in the whole Chicagoland area, including suburbs. And at some point they changed the zoning rules to make it easier. But you know, the BS I had to go through with the alderman at that time and the neighborhood groups, it was insane. I actually had a guy who was from the neighborhood group. Mm-hmm. Adjacent to us, who was upset that they allowed me in, create a fake organization and go to the zoning board and try to say they were against me being there.
Oh, good God.
I mean, the lengths that these people go through to keep you from opening. were insane.
What you have lived through, and you seem to have worked through, too, a period where tattooing went from the image of being as unsavory could be to really becoming... You know, I have friends of mine like Tony Fitzpatrick, producer Kevin Richter has a ton of tattoos that, you know, virtually it became a young person's thing and a real, they understood they were allowing not to just have a message on their arm, but to allow their bodies to become a canvas. When did that sea change start to happen?
Media is everything, you know. First,
tell me about
the tattoo magazines. When the tattoo magazines started, a whole new generation of people were exposed to tattooing, including myself. And so that brought in a whole wave of people.
Right.
Then you have the internet, websites.
Of course.
More, but the TV shows, Miami Ink, as that hit.
Yep.
Everything went nuts. And, the part that people don't think about, they don't really see. I mean, as a business, it's great. When I got into tattooing, it was more underground. I never anticipated it to be as busy as it is.
Sure.
But the part that people don't understand is people like myself who got tattooed 20 years ago and how the context was different, where then, you would be standing out from the crowd or you'd have something unique. Now I see 16-year-olds or 15-year-olds waiting for a bus, to have full sleeves. Everybody's
wow.
got full sleeves. Back then, you knew everybody in Chicago that had a full sleeve.
Yeah,
there
exactly.
was maybe 20 or 30 people total that had a whole back or a whole sleeve. Now, 20% of the city has a full sleeve.
Why is that?
You're blocked in with these people that, somebody's like, hey, I knew this was the way it was going to be 20 years from then. Who knows if I would have done it, It's different.
Right. Kevin Richter is one of the people, Benoit, he's the producer here, who heard of your shop and said, oh my God, Deluxe Tattoo. Kevin, why do you have tattoos?
I kind of grew up in the punk rock music scene and all that, and I think that kind of sparked my interest initially, and then you get one, and then, kind of snowball from there.
How does he sound to you, Ben? Does he sound like one of the crazies who used to come in, or does he sound like a normal potential customer?
I'd probably stand next to it at a show many times.
Yeah.
Sounds like, right.
How many tattoos do you have?
Me?
Both of you.
I'm pretty covered. I never tattooed my hands or neck or anything because, I like to, when I want to be nobody, I can be nobody, I don't like to be,
right.
And do you come up and grabbing you 24 hours a day, they handle you like you're a mannequin. You're like, oh, what's this? Why do you have that? Who are you?
Do you, Benoit, do you tattoo you can't possibly tattoo all of yours. There's certain places you can't reach,
no.
right? But you go to artists who you admire, right?
Absolutely, yeah. There are people that have definitely done quite a bit of work on themselves. I worked with a guy that tattooed his own neck. I've worked with a guy that did a portrait on his own leg of his favorite musician. I've seen people do amazing tattoos on themselves. But, most of the time you're going to have somebody who's not you doing your tattoos for you.
Yeah. What level of I would suppose, do you have a number of people working for you at Deluxe Tattoo?
Yeah, there's nine other people currently.
Okay, now with someone, obviously, you going to see you is like walking into art school and saying, well, I'll go with Gauguin here. I mean, you're obviously at that level, are you not?
Yeah, but no, this is the thing that the misconception. I mean, everyone has their own reason for doing tattoos. My reason is not to be that guy. I'm here, I'm working for you. You contact me, you want to get tattooed by me, you want to wait, you want a stick figure, I'll do it. You want me to do something that you drew, I'll do it. There's people out there that, they just don't want to do that. They're quote-unquote above that. And I get it, and I don't want to judge those people. If that's what their life's about, fine. But, I come from a time when you'd sit there and play Scrabble with your friends at the shop or Domino's waiting, hoping someone's going to come in that door to get something cool. Maybe they're going to come in and pick something off the wall that takes an hour. Maybe they're come in and, I heard about your work and I want you to draw this for me and do something cool. It's a roll of the dice every day. You'd walk in there and wait. Now it's busier, and that's good. I'd never forget that, that waiting and that hoping that you're going to get to do something cool.
Wow.
And so I respect people, and I respect if that's what you want and that's going to make your life better. You want me to do it for you? I'm flattered. Let's do it.
That's a lovely, lovely, Benoit. That's a lovely philosophy. Kevin Richter, you have heard of Ben Storr. You have certainly heard of Deluxe Tattoo.
Yeah, I think it's pretty well known in Chicago.
And greatly admired?
Oh, absolutely.
Why did you go somewhere else? Why did you have Jim DeCastro make your tattoo? Just joking.
You know, I think at the time when I went into certain shops, it was mostly proximity, and I liked the work, and I had a history with the artist.
Yeah.
And kind of just developed from there.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
And you got to go in.
I need to.
Hey, how much is a tattoo, Ben? This is something that I know it. I know the price must vary depending on size and things.
Our shop, some shops are much cheaper for whatever reasons. We start at 100 and go up from there. Mm-hmm. And it depends on what the design is, how intricate, how simple. If it's a one session tattoo, we will give a flat price. If it's a multiple session tattoo, we charge hourly. Hourly can range from $175 to $200 an hour, depending on the artist. And the problem with numbers like that is it's arbitrary. They don't really have an exact number.
Yeah, sure.
But technically, it actually breaks down to be cheaper than a flat price would have been.
Let me ask you another question. Yeah. I want you to get on your spring break, and I really appreciate you
coming
in.
No, take your time. I appreciate you having me.
It's my pleasure. How has the mechanics, the technology of tattooing changed in your life?
Not very much. The thing, I'm going to tell you. Tattoo artists, though, most of them are suckers for anything new. So you come along with a new product. It could be a soup can with a string on it. You could say this is the best tattoo machine ever created, and you're going to sell 1,000 immediately. And, you know, in my career, in my 25 years, I've seen, you know, waves of these new, you know, oh, this is the new thing. Everyone's going to be doing it. Everyone buys it, uses it for a year, puts it away, and goes back to the old way, you know. Things come and go. But the actual technology, no, it's pretty... You know what's been for over 100
years. Give me a sense, because I'm very, very intrigued by this. Give me a sense of who at 1461 West Irving Park, and the website is deluxe with an E tattoo.com. Who walks into your store as a new customer? I mean, can you characterize the sort of clientele you have? I'm sure you have a ton of repeat customers.
Well, you know, Lakeview has changed so much over the years.
Yeah.
You know, and so definitely, it's funny because the old storefront, we wouldn't see out the front window. And once we moved next door, you know, a few years ago, like 5 years ago, into a bigger space, and we had front windows. And now I could see who's walking by the shop all day.
Right.
It's a freak show up there. Jesus Christ. I'm like, what the hell are these people doing in Lakeview? So you get everybody, you know. You get a utility worker guy that's in the neighborhood working that strolls in, you know, wants to ask about a tattoo. You get bored moms. You get nannies. You get cops. You know, everybody.
Radio you're going to have a radio producer walking in there soon. Kevin's getting very intrigued here.
I'm going to tell you one that you're not going to believe me. This guy comes in with a suitcase, and he wants to get a tattoo because he's on the way to the airport. Oh, yeah, where are you going? Africa. Oh, yeah, what are you going to do in Africa? I'm going there to meet a lion. I'm going to go in the wild and try to meet a lion. I'm not kidding.
I believe you.
So we Google this guy, and sure enough, he's got, like, all these weird books about man's interactions with nature and all this. This guy was literally on the way to the airport to go to Africa. Go in the outback, whatever, in the wild, and try to find a lion and meet it.
What kind of tattoo did he want?
He got, like, some numbers, you know. He got, like, some thing to commemorate the day.
Oh,
like,
man.
The date. But this guy was seriously, you know, you want to talk about walk-ins.
Here's yeah. Walk-in. Have you ever, I'm sure you have, Benoit, the owner, operator, and artist of Deluxe Tattoo, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. Saturday, April 22nd, from noon to 10 p.m. at 1461 West Irving Park Road, Deluxe Tattoo, deluxe with an E, .com. Have you ever, for any reason at all, turned down someone's request for a specific tattoo?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's funny because there was a guy working for you at one point, and these people came in, and they all had, like, badges around their necks, and they were obviously mentally not all there. And they had somebody with them. And this guy was talking to the guy that works for me about a tattoo. And the guy that works for me, I could see, I was tattooing at the time, but I could see him talking to the guy about this, giving him a prize. And the guy, you know, I don't know what his mental condition was, but he was showing a tattoo he had already on his back to him and saying, I already have this one, I'm going to get another one. So they walk out, and I say, what are you doing? You can't tattoo this guy. He's, like, not even there. He goes, what are you talking about? I'm like, I heard you were giving him a price. He showed you the tattoo he has. He goes, yeah. Do I know what tattoo he had on his back? I go, what? He goes, there was nothing there. He didn't have any tattoo.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. Wow.
That's a lot of it. Yeah,
yeah, that's so. A good story. How old are your kids?
2 and 7.
They don't, do they get what, do the 7-year-old get what you do?
Yeah, she actually drew her name when she got in kindergarten, and me and my wife tattooed it on each other. My wife does not tattoo, by the way, so that was one of the most painful tattoos I've ever gotten.
Wow. But, That must have been some first aid. What do you do, honey? Well, I'm a tattoo artist. You obviously, Ben, I thank you again for spending this much time, and you've really educated me about this whole thing. Do you find that you are, as an artist, growing with every year that your work is becoming more you?
Well, what happens is it's hard to say because you're not really growing, but as much as changing.
Yeah,
so
gotcha.
People come in with a tattoo I did 10 years ago, and it'll look good, but I just don't do things that way anymore. And I'll think to myself, man, I need to take a photo of this and start doing things that way again. Like, how did I get away from doing this? You're just constantly the brain, you know, you're constantly evolving.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say it's better or worse. It's different, you know.
Okay, one more question. What are you going to do? What's going to go on during this 20th anniversary celebration Saturday from noon to 10 p.m.? 14.
Well, we'll have commemorative, you know, 20th anniversary shirts for sale and gifts for, you know, old clients. It'll be nice to see, you know, some old clients come by and say hi. I haven't seen in a long time. And just, you know, generally just being there to meet people and talk to people and, you know, be open.
Ben, you're a fascinating guy. A Jew from Beverly. That's one of the unique. Yes, that's a unique class. Thank you so much for doing this, and I hope you and your family have a lovely little trip down there. You're a very interesting and very extremely thoughtful guy. So I my absolute pleasure. So have a great vacation, and I'm going to come up and see you because I also I also write for newspapers. That's my
people tip. Read those things?
I know. I'm going to have you do the front page of the Tribune.
God.
I mean, my
oh,
first ta- no, my first tattoo is going to be the entire front page of the Tribune on my back. Or just, Ben, you're going to have to write really small. These are small typeface here. We'll talk about that, Ben. I hope to meet you soon. Thank you. Happy holiday, too.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Okay, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Bye.
We're done here. Thank you so much for listening. We have to go back. Who's on now? John Williams is on. So? Oh, we have to break here. Bob Ferguson, I Would Die Without You. That, again, is Michael Miles. I'll be on the radio Sunday night, as usual, from 9 to 11. And I'll be at the Hideout at 6:30 Tuesday with Michael Miles, the guy you've been listening to play all day, doing a kind of, not an homage, just a kind of show about Mike Royko and what he wrote and what he said, and play a little of that softball tape. So thanks for listening. It was fun to fill in for Bill and Wendy, and it's always fun to talk to you. Thanks to Bob Ferguson, the world's greatest engineer, and Kevin Richter, the greatest producer with a ton of tattoos. I'll put it that way. Thanks a million.